Good morning. Before I begin, can we just show our appreciation to Christy and to the deacons for putting the service together, and my friend Jackie for the Schubert this morning. For about 15 years at two different newspapers, my job was to write daily editorials. These are the official opinions of the newspaper's editors and senior management on the issues of the day. Now, I've heard it described that an editorial writer is the person who rides down to a battlefield after all the fighting is done and shoots the wounded. I love the work, but after a decade or so, my brother Mike observed, everyone is entitled to Stephen's opinion. So let's do some math. Say 350 editorials a year for 15 years equals roughly 5,250 opinions. Now, I did all the homework I could before taking a position. I aggressively listened to all sides. Yet, what percent of those editorials do you think were wrong? A third? Half? I know there are some readers from that time might say all. I remember criticizing Susan Sweetser when she was running for Congress for failing to abide by Vermont's new campaign finance law. Susan called me the morning the editorial appeared, and rather gently, considering the circumstances, she reminded me that the law applied to candidates for state office, and she was running for a federal office. Oh, that. Once I wrote a piece arguing that Vermont should reject the multi-million dollar settlement the tobacco companies were offering as a penalty for marketing to kids as insufficient. The then Attorney General Bill Sorrell called and in the span of 3 minutes realized that in print, I had it completely, undeniably wrong. Hey, but that was only 26 years ago, right? I've almost completely forgotten it. Maybe one of these decades. After 5,000 editorials, life begins to resemble nothing more than the Zen parable of six words. Open your mouth and you're wrong. I would say the opposite is the case in our culture today. Lately, I encounter more certainty in others than any time I can remember. Something about the civic fabric of our era cultivates a people just dead positive that they are right. Spend 10 minutes on social media and you'll see it aplenty. Donald Trump tweets something ugly and millions of people, this is not an exaggeration, millions rise up in condemnation. Another millions, albeit somewhat smaller, rise up in defense or in attacks on the critics. Everyone is so certain. It does not take a president to start these fires, nor to show who gets burned. 2 weeks ago in Charlottesville, Virginia, a group of 25 Ku Klux Klan members came from North Carolina to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. More than 1,000 counter-protesters showed up. So far, so good. After 20 minutes or so, the Klan's men and women wanted to leave. The counter-protesters wouldn't allow it, blocking their cars and the road. When police asked them to disperse, they refused. Eventually, 23 people were arrested, and the police had to use tear gas. What were the results? First, the clash gave national media attention to about 24 racists, many of whom were quoted in all the coverage. Second, the KKK considered the event so successful, they scheduled another rally in the same place for August 12th. The excessive zeal of the counter-protesters, their ironclad certainty, actually diminished their moral authority. This national scorn, by the way, is positively gooey with hypocrisy on both sides. People who held hair-trigger social media shotguns, if anyone said anything critical about Hillary Clinton's appearance, have no qualms about mocking Donald Trump's hair. People who despised FBI Director James Comey for revealing an investigation of Hillary's emails 8 days before the election have subsequently sainted him for testifying last month in a way that damaged the president. On the other side, meanwhile, Trump and his supporters gleefully call the inaugural crowd the biggest ever when clearly photos prove the opposite because they find delight in the howls of complaint from reality huggers. Vermont is not immune. Last February, a woman in Burlington posted on Facebook that she hoped Trump would bring back slavery because she was exhausted and her house was a mess. That's pretty offensive, right? A friend advised the woman to take her post down, and she replied that obviously it was only a joke. Of course she didn't support slavery. An hour later, her post had been forwarded 66,000 times, reaching millions of people. She received thousands of hate mails and more than 100 death threats. She lost her job. She wound up in the hospital under a suicide watch. I don't defend anything about what the woman posted, not one word, but I question the ferocity of the world's response, the utter lack of mercy. I worry about it. In Burlington, the Muslim man who is head of Vermont's Democratic Party received threats for backing Sharia law, which is a complete fallacy. The man charged with the hate crime in the incident was so certain of his Vermont pedigree, he allegedly emailed, "Get out of my Green Mountain State." In South Burlington, two different men have been charged with harassing or threatening youngsters over the change in the school mascot. Such big, manly adults, so certain of themselves. Perhaps you know what happened when conservative author Charles Murray came to speak at Middlebury College back in April. The liberal student protesters turned into a mob, would not let Murray leave, and wound up injuring a faculty member who actually agreed with their distaste for Murray, but had the audacity to debate him instead of shouting him into silence. Certainty was so fierce, it led to the injury of an ally. I wish I could say that we never see this kind of attitude in Charlotte. I wish. Only observe Front Porch Forum, however, for all its virtues. As regular as the cycles of the moon, every month there's a subject on which people not only disagree, which is normal, but do so with disdain, condescension, and suspicion about some secret agenda. If you don't believe this town has its fair share of scorn, I encourage you to take a bike ride on any of our paved roads. I don't care if you go alone, obey all the laws, and hug the shoulder the whole way. You will feel the hate as often as every 5 or 6 miles from people who honk and shout and throw things, swerve to scare you, on and on. And as you're rolling along, meanwhile, see if you can count all the blue Bud Light cans in the underside grass, a sure sign of disdain for Charlotte's natural beauty, though it is one of the town's greatest blessings. In all, it reminds me of a bumper sticker I saw the other day, "Often wrong, but never in doubt." I can't help wondering two things. What is this self-righteousness all about? And is it good for us? For our souls, I mean. Part of the answer, in my view, is to consider the problem more consequential than one moment in politics. In 1998, the marriage researcher John Gottman videotaped newlyweds having a 15-minute make-believe argument. 6 years later, he went back to see which couples were no longer together, then reviewed the videotapes to see if there was any warning sign, any way to predict. He found that there was one: contempt. If either person showed a facial expression of contempt for the other, it was highly predictive of a later split. He tried using tiny snippets of tape, turning the sound down and other gimmicks, and he only became more accurate. At one point, being able to look at just a few seconds of video, silent video, and predict with 83% accuracy whether the couple would still be together in 6 years. All he had to observe was one moment of contempt. Perhaps today, America is like a divorcing couple, full of venom for one another, reduced to bickering over the possessions. Because nearly all you can see in our public discourse is contempt. That person is not only wrong, but he or she is also stupid, immoral, corrupt. This attitude strikes me as incredibly dangerous. Countries are not guaranteed a permanent existence. If Pearl Harbor happened today, do you think we would rally as one to defeat a shared enemy? Or are we spectacularly vulnerable? We dismiss the nation's atmosphere of conflict as justified by today's dirty politics and the politicians who practice it. Indeed, it is hard to believe that we are the same nation that 50 years ago this month celebrated a summer of love. But think of this. If Hillary Clinton had won the election, her budget would be as dead on arrival as Donald Trump's. Her Supreme Court nominee would not be getting a hearing. And she would definitely be under investigation for email improprieties and probably be facing impeachment. In other words, the division would be nearly as intense as it is now. If the enmity is equally fevered, regardless of who is president, then the problem does not lie in the White House. It lies with us. Politics is the symptom. We are the disease. Even that predicament might be okay if it worked. If we were participating in a wrestling match that ended ultimately in polity and peace, but contempt changes no one's mind. All it does is cement their views. I believe we may be better served by dwelling for a moment on our flaws rather than everyone else's. I can think back over the past 7 days, for example, and recall many ways in which my conduct was wanting. I can remember deeds and thoughts I would be ashamed to admit from this pulpit. How about you? Did you have a perfect week? Was your attitude to uplift everyone around you, or were you quick with criticism? Were you the ideal parent, spouse, co-worker, and citizen, or were you imperfect? Did you receive your news from responsible neutral sources, perhaps including those with whom you disagree? Or was it from the smug, cynical, and condescending Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh, or the smug, cynical, and condescending Bill Maher and Stephen Colbert? Were you a generous commuter? Or did you feel contempt for other drivers on your way to and from work? In what is an almost ideal metaphor for the point I'm trying to make about blaming others rather than investigating our own contribution to civic division, please let me remind you for the next time that your car is standing still. You are not in traffic, you are traffic. In our certainty, we may have cultivated a habit that directly contradicts many of the teachings of our faith. Judge not, lest ye be judged. Remember that one? Forgive of the person who wrongs you 7 times 70 times. Turn the other cheek. How about love your neighbor? Yes, your neighbor whose dog barks all night, who mows the lawn or runs his chainsaw at 7:30 on a Saturday morning, and who votes for idiots. Yes, love that person. Or the clincher from today in Matthew today in the reading. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? These were not only religious ideas, by the way, they were political too. These words came from a Jewish man living under Roman occupation. It would be like forgiving 7 times 70 times a Nazi in 1940s Paris, or a machete-wielding Rwandan in 1990, or a fanatic from ISIS in Aleppo today. It means turning the other cheek without doubt to haters on both sides who dominate public discourse today. How do we do this? I find it immensely difficult. That sawdust is so tempting. You may disagree with me on all of these issues, for example, but I believe a heating planet is a central concern of our world, and our national politics pretend otherwise. I believe the danger of nuclear weapons is no longer in decline. I think prolonged extreme and economic inequity yields injustice and then riots. I believe persistent racism mars the national conscience. I believe 34,000 gun deaths a year, the preponderance of them suicides, demand a conversation that does not instantly collapse into passion without solving anything. On these matters, I do not want to hug the enemy. At the same time, I don't want to become part of the problem. You see, indulging in contempt for others invites them to show scorn too. When someone shows contempt for me, their self-righteousness absolves me from having to investigate my own conduct and beliefs. I suspect that none of the challenges we face today will be solved by disdaining the people we disagree with. However difficult the issue may be, however strong our emotions may be, we might just have to hold our temper and quiet our certainty and be peacemakers first. After all, we live in a democracy, a form of government predicated on the notion that there is value in each person's opinion. That means those folks who don't agree with you are never going away. The real issue, anyway, to my mind, is not how we solve any one particular problem, but rather how we choose to treat our fellow human beings, all of them, regardless of their views, and how that choice may help or hinder our spiritual journey. If we are to achieve a proper division of church and state, we must first accomplish a division of church and hate. So I've been collecting some stories that show me, if not the way, then at least a way. Perhaps you know about the chain gang in Georgia that was being guarded by a sheriff's deputy who collapsed in the heat. The prisoners persuaded a passerby to call 911 while they administered CPR until an ambulance arrived. The convicts are credited with saving the deputy's life. True story, happened June 22nd. Surely you know about the 2015 massacre by Dylann Roof, who murdered 9 African-American people during a prayer service in Charleston, South Carolina. When Roof appeared in court days later, survivors of his attack, still wearing bandages, as well as family members of those who died, testified that they were praying for him and that they forgave him. Or the example, unforgettable in brutality and beauty, in rural Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania. One morning, Charles Carl Roberts IV stormed into a one-room Amish schoolhouse, made the boys and teacher leave, then shot 8 of the 10 remaining girls. 5 of them died before Roberts shot himself. Within hours, members of the local Amish community went to the homes of Roberts' parents, siblings, and widow, arriving by horse-drawn buggy with casseroles and prayers and words of forgiveness. One Amish man held the killer's father in his arms for an hour while he wept, repeating, "We love you, Roberts. We love you, Roberts." True story, October 26, 2006. These stories, in which people turn their cheeks to the hardest blows imaginable, they demonstrate what is possible for us when we confront injuries that are much smaller. Doesn't hearing them do something for you? Doesn't it give you a bit of hope? Here is the work that our faith calls us to. Here is the challenge of our time, to maintain our principles without awarding ourselves a place of judgment, to remain humble in the certainty that some of the time we are wrong, to reject scorn and instead seek paths of empathy. Of course, I could be mistaken about all of this. So let us give the last word, therefore, to the source of sources. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Amen.